Thank you very much. We'll make a start. I think one or two more people are going to appear. But as we've only got the hour, I want to use as much of it as we can, as usefully as we can. Today we've got a very topical subject. It's not the first time that Global Strategy has talked about cybersecurity, but it goes on being topical because it keeps on changing. And as a result, it's a subject to which we will return quite rightly on a number of different occasions. Today, the title of the lecture is Cybersecurity, Global, National, Organizational and Personal Vulnerabilities. And I was struck this morning when I listened to the news and heard of the interference that had been with certain major systems in South Korea, with rumors that these may have been caused by their northern neighbors. This was a very good day on which to remind ourselves of the sensitivities of this particular area in terms of the security and best interests of not only our country, but also our industries and as individuals in the future. Today we're very lucky to have to speak to us a man who knows an enormous amount about this, General Peter Pace, who is a retired general of the United States Marine Corps. He retired from active duty on the 1st of October 2007, after more than 40 years of service. He was, in fact, sworn in as the 16th chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on September the 30th, 2005, and in this capacity he served as the principal military advisor to the President, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council, and the Homeland Security Council. Prior to becoming chairman, he served as vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he holds the distinction of being the first Marine to have served in either of these positions. He was born in Brooklyn. He was commissioned in June 1967. He graduated from the United States Naval Academy. He holds a master's degree in business administration from George Washington University, and he attended Harvard University Senior Executives in National and International Security Program, and he graduated from the National War College. He's had a very distinguished career. I hope you'll forgive me if I don't go through all the details of it, because I think we would spend quite a lot of time if I was to do that. He's a very distinguished and decorated man. But in June 2008, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honour a president can bestow. And I think we're very lucky to have him to speak to us today, and I'll ask him to address us now.
Thank you very much. If you don't mind, I'll stand up. Thank you, Representative Lozian. Thank you for that very kind introduction. I think I'll stand so I can see the folks in the back. And if my voice trails off a little bit, just wave at me in the back and I'll understand. I appreciate this opportunity. It's a privilege to be here in Parliament, to the House of Lords, and in this very special chamber. So thank you for the invitation. Folks often ask me what keeps me awake at night, what hot spot around the world keeps me awake at night, and I tell them, quite honestly, it doesn't. Because for most of the hot spots you can think about around the planet, although we may not always get it right, as nations we have ways of dealing with most of the problem. Most of them have to do with either economic challenges that we have ways to deal with or military challenges that we have ways to deal with. And as I said, we may not get the solution right, but for the most part, we know how to deal with those kinds of things, except for one very important area, and that is cyber attack and cyber defense. For the 4 years I was vice chairman and 2 years I was chairman of the Joint Chiefs, it was my responsibility to know what the capabilities of the United States were, and when any of our military commanders asked to be able to use those capabilities, to take it to the president and recommend whether or not we should, and if I recommended what the impact would be. It's because of those 6 years and since I've retired my continuing interest in cyber that I know quite clearly what my nation can do offensively in cyberspace. And I know that we as a nation cannot defend against what we can do offensively. And as a military man, that concerns me. First, because potential enemies may be trying to do what we can do, or they currently can, or worse, they may have thought of something already that we have not thought of. But in cyberspace, cyber attack, the attackers are way ahead of the defenders. And as I said, I know what my nation can do, and I know that we cannot defend against what we can do. Nothing I say tonight is going to be classified. I have what they call bots out there on the internet that feed to me all of these cyber articles that are out there on a daily basis. So I read what's been published to see what's still at least somewhat secret. So things I talk to you about tonight will be things that have already been published. There are several layers of cyber to be concerned about. Nation states, nation-sponsored, terrorists, criminals, and hackers. And pretty much in that order as far as magnitude or severity. At the top, you've got nation states. And the advent of cyber weapons is impacting the relation between nations the way that the advent of nuclear weapons impacted the relations between nations. The difference being that nukes were used some 60-plus years ago, and thank God have not been used again. Cyber weapons are being used thousands of times every single day. At the national level, you have supercomputers, billions of dollars of investment by the UK, by the US, by Russia, by China, by Germany, by Israel, by France. Nation states have invested enormously in this capacity. And like with nuclear weapons, cyber weapons are basically being self-deterred by the nations that have the capacity. Most of the time when I took something into President Bush to make a recommendation, my recommendation was, don't use this weapon for this purpose. Why? One, because if it were used against us in that regard, we would consider it an act of war. And second, because we have a separate way of dealing with this. We don't need to use cyber. Those are the primary reasons that I would use. Additionally, you don't want to be, if you don't have to be, the first person to use that kind of capability. But nation states are basically self-determined. But even when they decide to use these weapons, and as much thought as goes into it, there are unintended consequences. This should still be highly classified, but it's been broadcast enough times on the net now where it's not. And that is that the Stuxnet attack in 2010 against the Iranian nuclear weapons program was a nation state going against a nation state. And the thought behind the attack was that to enrich uranium, to make it highly enriched uranium, you must have centrifuges that are rotating at a very precise speed for a very precise period of time. The attack that was developed was to reach out to the power source of those centrifuges and to perturbate the power grid between 50 and 60 cycles to get the centrifuges to start to wobble and self-destruct, which is what happened. So you had someone thousands of miles away pushing the enter key, sending bits and bytes downrange that had kinetic impact on the other end. Only nation states have that capacity right now. But even, as I said, those who have it have to be extremely cautious in how they use it because there are unintended consequences. In this case, again, this has been published. When the attack went downrange over the internet, it went to a lot of power sources on the globe, looking for the right power source. And it attacked the power source that it was designed to attack. But it is now resident in all the power sources that it found that it didn't attack. Unintended consequence. Which means that whoever sent it downrange in the first place possibly could use that against those sources, and perhaps somebody could reverse engineer and use it against those sources. Below nation states, you have state-sponsored events, or at least state-condoned. Examples of that, in 2007, the NATO nation of Estonia decided that they no longer wanted to have a Soviet-era war memorial on their property. They took it down. That made some folks in Russia unhappy. And from Russia, not the government, but from inside of Russia, an attack was placed onto the Estonian internet. It was a denial of service attack, which means that they used a million computers from 70 nations and had those million computers call into all the Estonia, so that an internet node that would normally get 1,000 visits a day was getting 2,000 visits a second. If something happened in London right now, and we all got on our cell phones to call home, none of us would be able to talk because the airways would be jammed. That's basically what this attack from Russia did to the Estonian internet. And they did it for 2 weeks, just to prove a point. They were not able to reach in and change ones and zeros into zeros and ones. They were simply able to carpet bomb the net, so to speak, in a way that was not usable. In 2008, when Russia went into the country of Georgia, the same thing happened to the Georgian nets. When they also reached out and touched President Saakashvili's computer on his own desk just to let him know they could do it. In 2009, perhaps similar to what's happening right now, the North Koreans rented a botnet, and I'll explain that in a minute, and attacked South Korean computers and U.S. computers. A botnet is a configuration of computers that one individual or one group of individuals is controlling, no matter where they are on the planet. There are estimated to be about 2 billion plus computers hooked into the internet at any given time. Of those 2 billion computers, about 10 to 15% are believed to be zombie computers being used by bot herders to put together these networks. So when you turn your computer on, you're using it, so is somebody else. When you've downloaded some kind of malware, you don't know it, your computer's on, they're using the power of your computer hooked into maybe a million other computers to do these kinds of denial of service attacks that I've talked about in Estonia and in Georgia. Even when your computer's off, you think it's off, it can be turned on remotely. So if you think about it, sometimes when you put your computer to sleep, you turn it back on and it says there's new software available to download. That sign and the software was delivered to your computer after you turned it off. But in this case, someone you authorized to do it, Microsoft, for example, turn it back on and download and stuff because you've authorized them to do it in your agreement. But just think about the fact that when you turn it off, somebody else, having put a code into your computer by downloading a virus, perhaps, is able to use your computer when you don't expect it. So in 2007, going to Estonia, most of the computers were in Egypt, Peru, and Vietnam. In 2008, when they went into Russia and went into Georgia, most of the computers were in the United States. But these botnets are very, very large, powerful mechanisms, but they're brute force mechanisms. Below that level, you have terrorists. And terrorists are now the first and primary entity that we can't hold anything at risk. At the nation state and at the nation sponsored, you can reach out to nation states and say, hey, and you can get their attention through various economic means or various counterattacks to whatever they're doing to you. With terrorists, there is no such thing other than holding their lives at risk. But other than that, there's not much that a terrorist holds dear that you can use as a deterrence against them. As I mentioned, right now, they don't have that capability to reach out with the exquisite supercomputing power needed to change ones and zeros to zeros and ones. But I believe sometime in the next 5 to 10 years that as computers evolve, that small groups of individuals will get the capacity that only nations have right now. And when that happens, you know the terrorists will use them. Below that, you've got criminals. Criminals are using botnets to do things like do denial of service attacks on banks. You want your bank back? Pay our extortion money, we'll give you your bank back. Banks are paying the money because they cannot defend against it. They want their bank to function, and they don't want to tell their depositors that there's a problem, because they don't want to spook the herd. So they don't alert the herd because they don't want to spook the herd. They pay the ransom. The other way criminals use the internet is a couple years ago, if I wanted to go out on the internet and illegally buy the information about your credit card, a couple years ago it was about $16 per credit card, which is not a bad price for a credit card. But the open market being what it is, today there are so many folks out there selling your data, you can get your data for 50 cents per paper. Those are two examples of what criminals are. And then you've got the hackers, who are the most benign in one way, but they're also the biggest problem. If you go back to thinking about the internet 10, 15 years ago, when we just all started using computers, nobody worried about viruses. And then all of a sudden there was a virus on the internet, and it really slowed things down. It made it difficult to operate. When viruses first came online, there were about 5,000 new viruses a year. Now there are 15,000 new viruses a week. And it counts up somewhere around 75 million known viruses on the internet, put there by hackers, most of whom are just saying to their buddies, hey, watch this, and pushing the enter button. Some are not quite that benign. But if you think about 5 to 10 years from now, hackers having the ability not only to disrupt traffic on the net, but to change the data, to change your bank account, to stop the electric grid flow. If you start thinking about hackers having that capability, then you really have pause. So today, if a nation wants to turn the lights out here, turn the electricity off in London for a week or a month or 2 months, they can do that. It is why I say that cyber is an existential threat to our way of life. Nuclear weapons and cyber. Anything that is dependent on computers is vulnerable. The more dependent it is on computers, the more vulnerable it is. The banking system, the stock market, the electric grid, water supply, oil and gas, you name it. All your critical infrastructure and everything less important than that is vulnerable right now to nation-state attacks. And it's only because nation-states have things at risk that they self-deter. Or they are currently putting in what are called zero-day codes into our banking systems, our electric grids and the like, waiting for the problem that festers itself into some kind of conflict, and then they'll pull a trigger on those embedded codes. We don't know what we don't know about that. We know as friendly nations that friendly nations have the capacity to go do that to potential enemies. Therefore, we've got to presume and assume that they can do that to us. We have, as I said, 5 years, maybe 10 years, between now, when you have things you can deter, and when terrorists and hackers get the capability, and they may not be deterred. So what do we do? First and foremost, and why I really appreciate being invited to speak to you, is just to have as much information sharing as possible, even at the unclassified level, to understand the nature of this problem. It is huge. And then to understand what our own individual responsibility is. If we are in government, what might we do in government to facilitate business getting better prepared and governments getting better prepared? And if we're in business, what kind of target are we? Is your business the kind of business that has some kind of military economic power behind it or that provides that to your country? Are you a target because of a military action? Or do you have intellectual property that would be of great interest to somebody else to steal? Or are you both? Now, today, the Chinese are sucking our brains out, intellectual property-wise. They're pulling down more than a terabyte of data every single day. There are locations you can go to inside my government and yours where you can physically sit and watch the computer screen, and you can watch the data flow from business government locations in your country and mine to China. Mandiant, which is a commercial company inside the United States recently published an article tracing back to China. I was in China in December. They flat out denied even having any capability. They invited me to go, and when I told them that one of our major concerns is their cyber theft, this is the new leadership of the new government said to me, we don't have any cyber capability. I just laughed and said, certainly you did not fly me all the way over here to insult my intelligence. Come on. But they are, and they see nothing wrong with catching up to the West by stealing our secrets. If that is all they're doing, that is bad enough. But you've got to believe they're also putting in some zero-day things. And they do it in ways that are not what you would initially think. For example, the Joint Strike Fighter, J-35 Joint Strike Fighter. They've gone after not only Lockheed Martin as a major contractor, but they've gone after the computer systems of all the sub-suppliers to that aircraft. They've gone into their computer systems, which are less defended than Lockheed Martin's, and they found out, what does this piece do, and what are its vulnerabilities? What does this piece do, and what are its vulnerabilities? So you have, even before the airframe is in the air flying, you have the Chinese looking at the various pieces of it, and which pieces are the most vulnerable, and how to get at it, as an example. So back to what do we do? My guesstimate is that this is about a 20-80 solution, about 20% government and about 80% commercial. Government has 100% responsibility for protecting government systems and about 20% responsibilities in helping educate our business leaders on the nature of the threat and then helping them devise solutions. If I'm building a product and you're building a product and I know that we collectively have a cyber threat and I start defending against it and you don't, I'm spending money that you're not, you are outbidding me on various projects. You're getting the business, I'm not. If I have deep pockets, I might be able to hold on. But if I don't have deep pockets, I'm going out of business. And when the attack comes, you're going out of business. So I think it is proper realm for government not to reach in and direct how to, but to help business design their own tools to be able to protect themselves inside of an environment that says, for banks, by a certain date, we'll all be at tier one security. By another date, we'll be at tier two. By another date, tier three. Or for the electric grid, you pick any of the major categories that are of interest to our countries. So we have the incentive and the help needed to get these things moving. It'll also have the desired effect, I believe, of having a lot of these 10-pound brains who really like playing with computers, instead of being hackers, be the folks who start these new companies that are going to be needed to help us deal with this. If your government, I'll just use my own government, we have spent hundreds. I vote yes.
We're going to lose certain members for about 10 minutes. We'll keep going because we've only got the hour. Some of our members would have to go.
Yeah. I lost my phone.
It'll do this twice, I'm afraid.
In my own government, we have spent hundreds of billions of dollars to build our National Security Agency, which is world-class cyber attack, cyber defense. And now, for correct concerns about the U.S. military operating inside the borders of the United States, which we don't do, there's concern that we have two choices. One, build another capacity inside the United States, which in my mind is crazy. First of all, we don't have another $500 million in case anybody's been watching our news. And second of all, we don't have that many 10-pound brains to do this. So you don't want to dissipate your capability. Karat, General Keith Alexander, under Title 10 U.S. Code, works directly for the Secretary of Defense. Under Title 50, he works directly for the Director of National Intelligence. And my recommendation to my Congress is have title whatever it is that also has him work for our Secretary of Homeland Security. Now, for a military guy who's used to working for two or three different bosses and keeping that straight, that makes complete sense to me. I understand why my fellow citizens have privacy concerns. And understandable concerns that some guy with stars on his uniform is going to be controlling that much of our power and our air. Fine. Replace General Alexander with Mr. Somebody or Mrs. Somebody. I don't care. We'll make it one person so we can start pulling together how we defend our nation externally and how we defend our nation internally. Because in the internet, they're exactly the same. And if I send 20 emails between me and then the folks at that table right there, that I push the enter button 20 times, it's going to take 20 different routes to get to you. Some are going to be inside the UK, some are going to be outside the UK. Everyone's going to be different. So you cannot think about this as territory of the UK or territory of the US. This is cyberspace. And we have law of warfare for water, for at sea, on land, in the air, and in space. But we don't yet for cyberspace. Why? Because it's too young. And because folks are just starting to understand what's going on. So another thing we can do as governments is start talking to our potential adversaries about things that we might try together. You know, when we wanted to be more friendly with the former Soviet Union, now Russia, what we tried to do is rescue at sea drills between navies, ground pilot drills between air forces, to just start getting to know each other a little bit better. You can do the same thing in cyberspace. Pick a topic. Pornography. It seemed to me that most nations on Earth would want to limit pornography on the internet. Use that as a stepping stone, or anything else that people can agree to start working through what kind of protocols you need. How do you make this work? What are the things we need to do together? It's going to take decades, but it's going to take decades from when we get started, and we haven't gotten started yet. And I think I'll stop talking at you since I used up my 30 minutes and answer your questions. And I'm happy to continue the dialogue about cyber or about anything else you want to ask about. I would simply like to remind you all that I am here as a private citizen. I do not represent my country. I had that privilege a long time ago, but I don't anymore. So my answers are personal answers to your questions.